the novel Endless Love, which was written by my guest, Scott Spencer. And if my friend doesn't already know Spencer's writing, then I expect to hear embarrassed laughter on my behalf. That friend assumes I'm recommending the novelization of the teen makeout movie Endless Love, which starred Brooke Shields. The film bears only a superficial resemblance to the novel it was adapted from and completely violates the novel's tone. Endless Love is a remarkable novel. The book is written from the perspective of a 28-year-old man, remembering how his life was ruled by his obsession with his first love when he was a teenager, and how through succumbing to that obsession, he lost everything that mattered to him in the world, including his lover. Spencer sustains a fevered lyricism throughout the book, which was nominated for American Book Award when it was published in 1979 and was nominated again when it was published in paperback. Scott Spencer's new, much-anticipated novel, Waking the Dead, has just been published. Like Endless Love and his previous novel, Preservation Hall, Waking the Dead deals with obsession, moral confusion, and the struggle to maintain a very tenuous hold on sanity. The story of Waking the Dead is about a young lawyer who's about to fulfill what he and his parents have always thought was his destiny, to run for office. But as he enters the political arena to run for Congress in Chicago, his heart and mind are taken over by a vision that his lover is still alive, although he knows she was killed in a car bombing while transporting refugees as part of her work in the sanctuary movement. Spencer's last three novels are written in the first person, with an irony that can make you laugh out loud in the middle of the most despairing and tragic moments. He loves movies, and he's written a couple of screenplays, Split Image, which was about a young man who joins a cult group, and Act of Vengeance, which is a new movie that's about the murder of Joseph Yablonsky, who was running for the president of the United Mine Workers. Scott Spencer's new novel, Waking the Dead, has just been published by Knopf. Welcome to Fresh Air.
It's good to be here.
I'd love it if you'd start with a reading from Waking the Dead before we talk. So maybe you could set it up for us.
Well, I think the easiest thing to do would probably just read the very beginning. And we'll see if it explains itself. I think it might. Well, what I'll do is read from the very beginning, and then I'll stop for a moment and set up where I'll go next. Sarah Williams left for Minneapolis with our life together in the worst possible repair. I knew enough about the suddenness of things to know that you ought never say goodbye to someone you love without acknowledging that you might be looking at them for the very last time. I broke this emotional law, and 26 hours later, Sarah was pronounced dead and zippered up in a black rubber bag in Minneapolis Community General Hospital. And what has happened to Sarah is that in the midst of helping Chilean refugees find a sanctuary in a local church in Minneapolis, St. Paul, she's in a car that is destroyed in a radio-detonated car bomb. And Fielding hears about this on the national TV news and rushes to Minneapolis and is thrust into the confusion of that horror. And then we pick him up again when he and Sarah's father are on their way down to New Orleans with Sarah's body. I sat next to Sarah's father on the flight to New Orleans. Neither of us wanted the company of the other, but there was no way around it. His name was Eugene, named after his father. He sold insurance and acted as if this gave him a certain insight and competence in matters of life and death, as if he were a surgeon or a priest. He was successful, but not well-liked. Sarah was one of his three children, all daughters. He'd named her Sarah, S-A-R-A, thinking it was ladylike, fetching. She'd added the H to her name later on. They had argued about everything. She was the family outcast, and his love for her was not at all abiding. Sarah's mother's name was Dorothy, and she was afraid and evasive around Eugene. It was hard to say where her loyalties were. She seemed mostly to care about appearances, and even though it's probably an emotional impossibility to care only for the surface of life, Dorothy seemed to do so. Eugene and I watched the stewardess demonstrate the safety features of the 727. It was a rough takeoff, right into the wind, and it surprised me how fervently I wanted the plane to crash. Clouds raced past like torn, dirty rags. You could hear the engines straining. Then the no-smoking sign went off with a little ping, and we were securely airborne. Eugene lit up a cool and tilted his seat back. He tied off his white loafers and exhaled smoke through his nose. Sarah's body was in the belly of the plane. Minneapolis was beneath us, looking clean, ordinary, distant. Then it curved away as if the earth in its rotation suddenly jerked forward, and beneath us was the frozen stubble of farmland and the little blue enameled bumps, the silos. We were flying. We were going to heaven. When the stewardess came by, Eugene asked her for a vodka and tonic. They weren't serving drinks yet, but she seemed to know he was the father of the woman, the body, below. She seemed also to know who I was, and she asked if I wanted something as well. I said no, just because it was easier. When his drink arrived, Eugene took a bottle of pills from his jacket and shook one out into his hand. He had a large palm, and the lines in it had a faint reddish tinge. Want one? I shrugged. What are you taking? Dorothy's doctor gave me some tranquilizers, and I'm taking them, he said. He smiled, as if there was some tragic irony in a man of his enormous strength having to take a woman's medicine. Are they doing any good? I asked. I think so. I'm not so jumpy, you know. I put my hand out, and he gave me one. It was the same light blue as Eugene's suit on one half and dark brown on the other. I put it in my pocket. I'll keep it for later. The word later had a bad effect on me. Time was moving on, but it was empty now. The word later made me realize that my life might be very, very long, and that now I would have to live every second of it without her.
I really love the way you write. My guest is Scott Spencer, and that's an excerpt of his new novel, Waking the Dead. Does Waking the Dead represent a new direction for you in your writing?
Well, I suppose it does, but I feel that that's been true of all of my books. My first novel was basically a satire of the science fiction genre, and then Preservation Hall certainly was a departure from that. It was a much more personal story, and An Endless Love, I think, was a departure from that because it was really concerned with an unrestrained narrator. And Waking the Dead, of course, is, you know, working in a larger canvas than I've ever attempted before.
Your stories seem to me, and the narrative seems to me to be about obsession, to be obsessed with obsession and with lost love, with a love that you can never get back because she's gone from you forever or she's dead. Why are you that interested in obsession and in those kinds of extremes?
I have to answer this in a slightly roundabout way. I've never really used the word obsession. It's a word that seems to be used about me an awful lot, and it's you know, in otherwise brilliant articles about me, the word obsession seems to crop up. By my lights, we say obsession or almost as a way of giving a psychiatric label to a certain pitch of feeling, and we keep those who are capable of that pitch of feeling at arm's length from us by saying, ah, that's obsession. That lets us off the hook from having to wonder why we aren't acting with that kind of heedless emotional bravery. But, you know, with that petty quibble out of the way, I am attracted to characters who proceed without any emotional accountancy, who don't figure the profit and loss of an action, but just follow an instinct. I find that, you know, an attractive quality in people and in fiction. I think it offers a lot of possibilities.
After having read three of your novels, I've been really wanting to know if you've ever experienced the kind of separation and loss that your characters have. I've just always wondered that about you, and I don't mean that to be a very personal question, and I'm not sure if it is or not.
Well, it's a personal question, but I like personal questions. I think that if I had lived a life as torn asunder as the narrator of Endless Love or the narrator of Waking the Dead, I probably wouldn't be able to write novels. I think that you need a certain peace of mind and a place within yourself that you can stay and be comfortable in order to, you know, carry on the arduous work of writing a novel. So my own life hasn't been as brutally buffeted by fate as my narrators have been. But there must be something inside me that's drawn to that. And whatever that is, I've kept a secret for myself.
Even that feeling of lost love?
Yes, even that feeling of lost love. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have met the woman who I feel most, you know, cosmically attached to, and not only stayed with her, but married her and had children with her.
You said that you like characters who don't heed any restraints, who are unrestrained in their emotions. Let me ask you to read the opening paragraph from Endless Love.
Oh, sure. When I was 17 and in full obedience to my heart's most urgent commands, I stepped far from the pathway of normal life and in a moment's time ruined everything I loved. I loved so deeply, and when the love was interrupted, when the incorporeal body of love shrank back in terror and my own body was locked away, it was hard for others to believe that a life so new could suffer so irrevocably. But now, years have passed, and the night of August 12, 1967, still divides my life.
You seem so intimately acquainted with that kind of feeling. I just wonder how you know it so well. That feeling also that you can make one wrong move in your life, do one thing, let one thing get out of control, and your life has changed forever, and it's ruined. All the good directions are just ruined, and you can never go back.
Well, I'm not so sure that lives are ruined, but I do feel that, you know, that they take, that they are sometimes wrenched in a direction that they might not ordinarily have gone. I'm not so sure even a life is as tragic as David's is ruined. I think that that there's something about him that endures, and I think, you know, even more so with Fielding Pearson Waking the Dead, that his life isn't ruined, but it goes in directions that he himself could never have imagined. And if he would have remained firmly in control of his life one step at a time, his life may have been more orderly, but probably he wouldn't have learned half of what he ends up learning. And I think that's sort of like the horror and the great opportunity of fate.
The main characters in your book all have very interesting parents. And in a couple of the books, the parents are very neurotic and are also former communists or socialists. But they're communists or socialists who have become assimilated into the middle class and have a lot of kind of typically American middle class neuroses. Do you see children as having to, like, survive their parents' neuroses? Do you think that those neuroses get passed on?
Sure. I mean, you know, even our pets pick up our neuroses, so how are our children going to escape from them? But I think that it's something else that's passed on that's trickier than neuroses, and that's the hidden agenda of one's parents and the lives that your parents didn't get to lead that are unconsciously handed over to you to fulfill. And I think that's the real interesting stuff that gets passed between parents and children.
I'm going to ask you to do one more short reading.
Sure.
And this is from your new book, Waking the Dead. And this is a sequence about the main character's parents.
Right. This is, he sees them. They come down basically out of enormous loyalty to New Orleans to be with him before Sarah is buried. And coming with his parents are his sister Carolyn and his brother Danny, and they're remembering what it was like to be raised in Brooklyn by their parents. We stayed up late talking. I remember laughing. I remember Carolyn recalling the tricky little current events quizzes Mom forced us to take over breakfast. What kind of plane was Captain Jerry Powers flying on his mission over Russia when the Soviets shot him down? Answer, a U-2. Right? But wrong, silly. His name isn't Jerry, it's Gary. Like fanatical gardeners working in soil of questionable fertility, our parents slaved over us with a kind of diligence that certainly included love, but was not confined to it. And now, here we were, the three of us, bound together not only by the normal genetic magic of siblings, but by the sort of loopy heroic narrative that binds veterans of a long war. Veterans of the Asian Wars wear those satin jackets that say on the back, I know I'm going to heaven because I've spent my time in hell, and then they have a drawing of Korea or Vietnam. Danny had wanted us to wear jackets that said the same thing, but with a picture of our genteel, shabby brownstone in Brooklyn instead.
Your parents were active socialists or communists?
Yeah, my parents were quite active in the 30s and 40s.
Do you think of yourself as a red diaper baby?
It's such a, you know, having raised two children, the idea of a red diaper is so terrifying that I can't possibly think of it. But I think that what would sort of characterize the red diaper baby and the culture of the red diaper baby was very unlike my own life, because my father was a steel worker, and we lived in a working class neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. You know, so all of our friends and all my contacts with people were not with political people, but were with the kids from whose fathers either worked in factories or drove garbage trucks, or some of the loftier ones worked in stores.
What were your parents' ambitions for you?
Well, my parents were, I think, found the idea of parents having ambitions for children to be somehow objectionable. And whatever my parents' ambitions were, they whispered about them after I went to bed. However, when I did start showing an interest in writing, they were anything but discouraging. I mean, they seemed to feel that was a noble life and a life well spent.
You were politically active when you were a teenager, right?
Yes, and beyond.
And beyond, okay. But when you were a teenager, you were, I think, the executive secretary of the Illinois Socialist Party.
Yes.
for a while.
Yes, you have my dossier.
That's right, we have your files. I prepare for interviews by sending to the Freedom of Information
That's
Act.
That's great. I'm so glad that they recognized me.
Now, was that part of your parents' influence, becoming active in that, or was...
Well, I think it must have been part of their unconscious influence, although... What really drove me into the Socialist Party, I shouldn't say drove me, led me to the Socialist Party, was reading a poem by Allen Ginsberg, was reading Kaddish. And he has a line describing his mother hitchhiking through Pennsylvania with the Young People's Socialist League. And I'd never heard of such an organization. And I felt at that time in my life very trapped in a banal existence, and I didn't know anybody who was interested in anything that I was interested in. I didn't know people who read books and who was, you know, who had my sort of incoherent feelings of rebellion, and that somewhere out there was a Young People's Socialist League just seemed to be a deliverance to me. And I wrote away to them and said that I wanted to join, and next thing I knew, I was in it.
And did that help you in, did you find sympathetic people there who were... what you were?
Well, actually, I found people who were quite a bit older than I. This Young People's Socialist League was not quite so young as I thought. I mean, what it was, it was University of Chicago people and people who were sort of hangers-on to that community, and some of them were as old as 30, it seemed, and many of them married.
What did you do to get yourself expelled? I understand you were expelled.
I was expelled for signing a document, actually, sort of denouncing the Socialist Party as too conservative. At that point, you see the Socialist Party, and still is, rather close to the Democratic Party. I mean, even though they have ideas that are certainly distinctive, that their overall strategy was that to act as a pressure group inside of the Democratic Party and to try and make it more liberal, which... the people who were giving me my political education were completely opposed to, and they were enormously excited to have me in the Young People's Socialist League because my father was a steel worker, and I suppose looking at it in a very banal way, just about the most normal face they'd ever seen in their life, and so I was. Quickly prepped, and whenever there was a document to sign, my name found its way onto it.
When you left the Socialist, did you stay political, or did you become a young literati then and team up with all the people in the English department?
Well, I think that a couple of years of intense politics fulfilled my taste for being a part of any coterie. And I think a lot of my desire to step away from politics was a desire to read and to become interested in literature, but that didn't lead me really into working on the Lit magazine or you know, hanging around with people and talking about literature. It was sort of the beginning of a private time in my life that lasted a very, very long while, that basically involved reading everything that I could get my hands on and writing and not showing it to anybody.
Why didn't you want to show it to anybody?
I felt that I wasn't ready. I felt that even something like taking a writing course in college would be, I don't know, sort of like opening the egg while the chick was still an embryo. It might not go any further than that. I felt that quick encouragement would only keep me frozen at the stage of the development that I was in, and any discouragement whatsoever would be too painful for me, because I didn't have an enormous amount of confidence in my desire to become a writer. I'd never met a writer. I didn't meet a writer. I mean, I met people who wrote, but I never met a writer who actually published anything until I was about 25 years old.
Not even in college?
Well, once James Dickey came to our college, and he was teaching there, and although I didn't take his course, I was at a party that he was he attended, and I remember he was talking about Walker Percy, and he kept on repeating this line from the moviegoer that, you know, she had a rear end that brought tears of gratitude to my eyes. Isn't that a great line? And I said this guy is so hip, it's unbelievable. I could never be this hip.
Were you turned off by some of the pretensions that you saw around you by would-be writers? Because it's, I think, pretty typical in college for young writers to adapt the most flamboyant characteristic of their favorite writer and hope that that's going to make them a better writer somehow.
Yeah, it's true. And I think it's wonderful. And I think that I was a prig for being for being turned off by it, because I think that they ended up having all the fun. And I just would, you know, be clucking to myself, you know, about how undeserved their pretenses were and how it was all, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing. But I think that they were absolutely right to do that, because looking back on it, it just seemed like an enormous hoot. And I was sort of like, you know, some tiny Saul Bellow there furrowing my brow at them. I think I made a mistake, but it was, I guess, unavoidable given my character.
When did you come out as a writer and start showing people your work and start sending it to magazines to get published?
I like that idea of coming out of the closet as a writer.
Well, it sounds like you were pretty sequestered.
I was. I think that I started showing people what I was writing probably when I was about 25 years old. When I came, no, actually, it was before then. I met a painter in Boston who had a take on life that I thought was very aesthetic and quick and clever. Yet, since he was a painter, I didn't feel that I felt I could have a certain distance from whatever his judgment was. And I began showing him what I was writing, and he was enormously encouraging.
And you started sending it to magazines after that. Didn't you write under a pseudonym for a while?
Well, that was quite a bit later.
I see.
That I mean, being a totally unknown and unpublished writer, writing under a pseudonym would be rather gilding the lily, I think. I was a pseudonym.
So, what did you consider to be like your breakthrough, where you felt like, okay, I can do this. I am a writer. I will write. This isn't just a fantasy.
I knew that I was a writer, and I knew that I would write, but I didn't. I was very sensitive to the possibility of telling someone, "Yes, I'm a writer," and then them basically saying, "Yeah, says who?" So I didn't really feel that I could say that with any real confidence until a novel was published, and I was 28 when that happened.
Some writers have a monumental experience to write about, like a war that they lived through that can give them material for 3 or 4 novels. Others are very absorbed in, say, their religion or their ethnic identity or sexual preference or geography, and they identify with that and their novels reflect it, and they become part of a school of American writers, and they're reviewed in that context and read by people who have sympathetic alliances. But you don't seem to have any of that yourself. Do you know, I don't link you up with a school or with an ethnicity or a great moment in American history or a place or anything like that.
No, I don't have that. I mean, and sometimes I wish that I did, but I don't. And you can't will that into being. I mean, I suppose the central experience that I write from is just whatever it is that my life was. I think the only thing that's unique about me, and I don't know how unique it is that I was spent a lot of time looking at the culture from the outside, and coming from a working class background, I think gives me a certain angle of vision into the mainstream culture that some writers don't have. But other than that, I think that the thing that I always felt about me was that there was something very common and everyday about me, that my experiences and my take on the world weren't awfully much different from the people who were reading my books. It's just that they had assigned me the job of mulling over their experience. While they did what they did, I was going to do what I did, and I would get to ride around in the cars that they designed or built, and they would read my books, and we would have a kind of division of labor in that way.
Well, before you saw that as your territory, did you have any false starts where you were trying to be a writer that you weren't, or trying to write about things that you really didn't know, just in order to hook up with like a great theme or a great experience that you thought a young writer should have?
No, I didn't do that at all. In fact, I aimed under, if anything. my first novel was almost devoid of any personal content and was really almost an exercise in irony.
Have you ever seen yourself as a political writer? Do you see yourself as a political writer? And I ask that knowing how political you were when you were young.
I don't know if I would call myself a political writer in the way that I think most people think of that label. I think one of the things that has always fascinated me, and I think it's a theme that goes through most of my work, is how do we live together, and what is the difference between what you feel inside, that sort of the anarchy of one's inner life, and the responsibilities to the community as a whole. And I think that's sort of the dialectic that all of my characters have to cope with.
My guest is novelist Scott Spencer, and his new novel, Waking the Dead, has just been published by Knopf. When you started writing novels, the whole relevance of the form was being challenged. A lot of writers were writing experimental fiction, and a lot of people just were, literary people were losing interest in the traditional novelistic form, where there's, you know, a storyline and character development and things like that. Did that experimental form interest you at all?
Well, it did. It did briefly, although I have to say that the idea of the novel as story and as character development has always been central to my attachment to the form, and it's not something that I've gotten tired of, and it's something I hope I never get tired of, because I really feel that that's where the vitality of the novel is, and I think it also keeps a novelist more honest than he might normally be when you have to refer back to something that's in motion in time. But there was a time in my life when, for instance, William Burroughs's ideas of the novel were enchanting to me, and I went for about a year doing fold-ins and cut-ups and all kinds of surreal experiments with writing, and sort of taking the sentence apart phrase by phrase and then putting back together in a way that didn't make any surface sense, but it had a kind of mysterious poetry to it. And I wouldn't go so far to say that any of it was readable or could be of interest to anybody, but it had a kind of freeing up of effect on me. And I think that it led me to the sort of lyrical prose that I like to write now.
So although we don't get to read that stuff that you wrote, it affects what you're writing now.
Well, I think it had. I think it freed me up. It made me a less formal writer.
In your last three books, they've been written in a first-person narrative. Do you feel more free with that form, writing in the first person?
All of my books have begun in the third person, and I always feel determined to write them in the third person. I don't know. I think I must have some ancient idea that that's what grown-up serious writers do, is write in the third person. But what has happened in every case so far is that after I lay out the territory of my novel in the third person in the first draft, the person who the novel is really about emerges, and I give the narration over to that character. But again, I've begun a new novel now. It's in the third person. Whether or not 2 years from now, when it's printed, it'll be in the third person anymore. I hope it's in the third person.
Why do you feel that it being in the third person is so important?
Well, I think I'm tired of people saying, you know, oh, I like that part when you burn down the house, or I like that part when...
People assume it's autobiographical.
Well, there is, and even people who work in the book industries, you know, half assume that it's autobiographical. And since I write about people in such desperate circumstances, I don't know. I feel that it would be also a challenge for me to write a book in the third person. I think that the angle of vision is so much different.
I think of you as being a master of simile and metaphor. This is from Endless Love, and there's a scene where a taxi cab has hit the father of the girl that the main character's in love with. And it's hit him because he's running after to chase the boy. And there's this gruesome scene that you describe where the body's been thrown and the taxi cab's convulsing because the driver stepped on the brakes so quickly. And David, the main character, is seeing this all and describing it, and he's mortified and even feels responsible for it. And then he says, "People turn slowly, quietly. Faces wear that perplexed, slightly absent expression you see in the lobby after an avant-garde play. This is it? You tell me what it means." And I really broke up when I read that, because after this gruesome description of a man getting hit by a cab and having his body thrown down the street and then getting run over by a florist truck, the narrator's comparing it to like that dazed look after an avant-garde play when people are confused.
Well, there's of course a mystery that I think all writers have to grapple with, is, you know, how do you come up with metaphors? And I don't think any of us know how we come up with them. I think it's just a question of immersing yourself in that moment and then almost free associating and hoping that you're smart enough to throw out the real dogs before you go to press.
Have there been times where an especially bleak metaphor or something has almost offended some of your readers, or they didn't see the humor of it and you meant it to be funny?
Yes. Sure. There's been plenty of times. Of course, yeah, I wrote a script for this movie called Act of Vengeance. And even though it was produced for home box office, as a favor to me, they let a print come up, and we showed it at our local movie theater in the town that I live in Rhinebeck. There's a not-for-profit movie theater there called Upstate Films, and they gave them this film. And Act of Vengeance is a pretty dark story. It's about the assassination of an American hero. But along the way, there are a lot of what I considered very, very funny lines. And my wife and I, who were sitting there sort of chortling over these lines, and I noticed not one person in this movie theater was laughing. And, you know, see, a novelist doesn't have that kind of contact with readers.
You weren't there when I was reading your novels.
So I missed your laughter, and there's someone else who I wasn't there for, and I missed their frown and their shaking of the head. But I think actually what's happened in my life as a writer is that it's dawning on readers quite slowly, and in Waking the Dead more than ever before, that there is humor in my books. That my experience with my first novel is called Last Night at the Brain Thieves Ball, which I meant to be completely funny. And when it was bought by a publisher, by Houghton Mifflin, I came in and I realized that everybody in this publishing company thought that this was a terrifying cautionary novel about what could happen with electronic snooping and all kinds of brain experimentations. And I was so nervous and basically grateful that they were publishing this book that I didn't want to say anything to rock the boat. But I felt that once the novel was actually in public, that it would be recognized as the madcap spoof that it was. But the first review that came out was, you know, the most terrifying book since Orwell's 1984. And I thought, oh my God, I'm sunk.
My guest is novelist Scott Spencer, and his books include Endless Love and his new novel, Waking the Dead. Do you see language as offering you unlimited options? Do you always feel like, oh, there's more ways to say this than I've already said it? There's words to be used that I haven't tried before? Or do you ever feel like I've used it up? I've used up everything on the palette, and I don't have anything left to say or any new ways of describing it?
Well, no, I've only written four books. I would think that would be very arrogant for me to think that in four books I've used up the language or used up the possibility of story. I think that when people feel that they're in some kind of personal crisis. I don't think that you can use it up.
Have you gone through crises, either personal crises or writing crises, where it won't come?
Well, there are times, of course, when it doesn't seem to be there for you. And what I usually do is just not force it, because I hate that bleak sense that comes off a page that's forced. And but I think the greatest crisis I went through was after Endless Love, after having spent so much time writing it, and then realizing, well, it was time to go and write another one now. And I said, I really don't want to. I've just spent basically 10 years alone in a room, you know, writing three books, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life alone in various rooms. And so I just I took off a couple of years and wrote scripts and had a completely different experience as a writer and a different relationship to my life and to people around me. I suddenly had workmates and office politics and gossip, something I'd never had before. All the stuff that people who work in offices find so completely annoying and dispiriting, I was attacking with a relish of a starving person.
What kind of work were you doing that gave you that kind of those kinds of relationships?
Well, you know, just, you know, working in studios, you know, and then a producer would have a nervous breakdown, someone would have a divorce, someone would, you know, have a drug problem, an eating disorder, you know, alliances were broken, alliances were formed. I mean, the movie business is so much like an Elizabethan court anyhow, with people coming in and out of favor, that you were, you know, it's an enormous surge of stuff after living with myself for so long.
But then after all, you wanted to go back to the room and write another novel?
Well, yeah, sure, because that's really what my nature is. But it was nice to have some time away from it.
In your novels, I think you probably write several drafts before you're happy with it. Not being a writer, I can't imagine how depressing it must be to spend maybe a year on a draft and say, no, it's not working, I'm going to throw it out and start all over again. I mean, how do you keep your spirits up when you've decided to start all over again after you've already put a year in or however much time in on a book?
Well, it is hard, and you have to con yourself a little bit. First of all, you can't begin that first draft and calling it the first draft. I always start, you know, I said, I should be typing this right into a, you know, a printing press, because this is it. This is it. I'm the golden guy, and everything I'm saying is going to be just wonderful. And then you come to the point where you realize that you were completely lost, that you've been writing trash for the past 2 months, and that's why you've had a stomachache. And there's no question that it's depressing, but you know that feeling that you have when it's a new semester and you get a brand new notebook and you're not going to make any of the mistakes that you made, and you're not going to like write your girlfriend's name on this one and deface it or anything like that. So I get a brand new notebook, and I have that kind of cheerful clean slate feeling that this time it's going to be different. And this time it should be typed right into the printing press and it's going to, and I can con myself into believing this for every draft.
How do you know finally if you're on the right track or the wrong track?
Well, first of all, the nausea subsides. And I can keep going. That the novel, you know, it's almost like an engine catching. That I can keep going, that I don't have to generate the energy to get going anymore. That it's there, it's sort of waiting for me. And that it begins to spread out and dominate every thought. And I know that I'm fully engaged. But of course, sometimes you're wrong. I mean, sometimes you're wrong. You marry the wrong person. And all your friends know it, but you don't know it. And I so the novelist has, you know, has that same fear that this wonderful book that you're writing, that, you know, that you were made to write, you know, all, and everyone reads it, so what has he done now? But you have to trust your instinct. And I think that, that's one of the reasons why I've chosen to lead a kind of, you know, relatively isolated life, because I like keeping my own company and living with my own instincts, because I think that's finally all that can sustain you. Because you're right, it is. It's a huge and almost absurd undertaking, writing a novel.
Well, you are living a pretty isolated life. You're in a small town in upstate New York.
Yeah.
A lot of people know of Endless Love through the movie, which was...
Or the song,
that's right. What am I thinking? Of course, the song. The song was a big hit.
Yeah, bigger hit than the movie.
Well, the movie was highly advertised. You couldn't turn on TV without seeing commercials for it. And a lot of people think that somehow your book is like the movie, which it isn't, or like the emotions in the song, which it isn't. Did that movie ultimately hurt you in any way because people assume that you must have written the movie, or that your book is exactly like the film? It's like for teens, and it's about very, you know, it's about people who are good looking, and you know.
I don't know, really. I mean, I don't take my career's temperature like this, and you know, how am I doing? I don't know. I think after having spent so many years without even being able to get a reading on the thermometer, it's not something that I choose to do. I know that. This is what the movie did for the book. It gave me readers that I probably never would have had before, and whether these are readers who are going to be interested in me book after book, only time will tell. But I'm grateful for that. I mean, Endless Love sold a lot of copies in paperback before there was a movie, but after there was a movie, it sold another 500,000 copies. And I have to assume that the enormous majority of those second 500,000 readers were readers that were brought to me by the movie. And even if I can keep 50,000 of them, that's really quite a gift for a writer.
You just sold the rights to your screenplay for the movie, right? I mean, you just sold the rights. You didn't write the screenplay for Endless Love.
No, I didn't write that.
Would you do that again with another novel of yours?
Yes. Yeah.
Even different it would... You did. Which one?
Waking the Dead. Right. And I've tried to exercise more care this time. I mean, I didn't know anything about anybody. And, you know, I just sold it because, hey, I wanted to buy a car.
But well, you were living on unemployment while you were writing
Endless Love. I was living on unemployment when I was writing Endless Love. And then the unemployment ran out, and I was working at a job in New York, and then I got fired from that. And so I'd lived for a long time in complete economic uncertainty, like almost all writers do. I mean, I did a tally, and in before Endless Love, I'd written two novels, sold them both to paperback, sold one to England, wrote three books under pseudonyms, had a book option by the movies, wrote the screenplay, wrote a few short stories, wrote many short stories under pseudonyms, and altogether averaged under $4,200 a year. And I didn't feel like my life was in shambles. I felt really lucky because I hadn't been condemned to silence like most people are, like most human beings are, and even like most writers are. But it was nice to be given the opportunity to not always be wondering how I was going to pay the rent. So overall, I'm comfortable with the decision that I made to sell Endless Love. And of course, I wish it was a better movie. On the other hand, I wish almost all movies were better movies.
You've written a couple of screenplays. Do you like writing for movies?
Well, I like the aspect that we were talking about before. I like being a part of something that involved more than me and my own imagination. And I love movies. And it's been a challenge to try and to learn to work in this form. I mean, there's an enormous number of frustrations that come with working in the movie business. And I've been lucky because I've worked with some interesting people. I've worked with Robert Redford a couple of times and Brian De Palma and producers who have a lot of tact and taste and been fair. But the industry, you know, just has a lot of frustrations in it. And, you know, for a novelist who's used to being the studio, that I, you know, whatever I say went, it's been quite it's been often a very difficult experience having what I write subject to so many other people's decisions.
Are you going to do more of it?
I'm not turning my back on it forever. I think that I'd like to concentrate on writing another novel right now.
I read a piece of yours that was in Film Comment a few years ago. It's called Scott Spencer's Guilty Pleasures,
oh, yeah.
And it's about movies that you liked. And so you mentioned, among other movies, the Elvis Presley film Change of Habit and the Christopher Lee movie Horror of Dracula. And could you see yourself writing genre movies like that? Or would you have any interest in that?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't mind writing a wonderful Dracula film. I think that from what I've heard about that part of the movie business, the working conditions are kind of awful. And I think that if you do it as a lark, it could be fun.
What are the movies and what are some of the books that you feel have really been influential on you?
Well, I think that the books that have been influential for me, I think that the primary influential book was Lolita. And I think that all of Nabokov's work has had a real influence on my sense of what a book can do and what a book has to do. That, he, more than any other writer I can think of, can blend that sort of rhapsody. I don't want to say this because I'm afraid it'll scare people away from him, but that high art with that very powerful melodramatic sense that keeps you turning pages, that it's not finally about language. It's language that's used as a way of seeing into hearts and into human destinies that you wouldn't have been able to see before. So Lolita and Nabokov as a whole have had a real influence on me. But on the other hand, I'm influenced by writers who I think Nabokov couldn't stand.
Like
Dostoevsky. I think that he didn't like Dostoevsky, but I think he liked Dickens quite a bit. And I was also very taken with Dickens.
You said that one of the things you love about Nabokov is that the way he uses language, it's not finally about language, it's about seeing into people's hearts. Is that the way you feel about writing, that it isn't finally about language, it's about bigger things?
I think that language as some sort of separate entity has never had enough in it for me. I mean, maybe I don't understand it well enough, but it certainly isn't what I want my books to be about. And even though people say that my books are very written and that they love the language and how I write, and I deeply appreciate hearing that because I work hard on it. I think that finally what all that has to fall away, and you see through that into a sort of the irrational core that lies beneath the language. And you, I mean, I mean. I don't want to make it sound like science fiction, but you go beyond the word into some meaning that lies in some inexpressible part of the mind.
My guest is novelist Scott Spencer. So far, the books of yours that I've read have been about fairly young men whose selves aren't fully formed yet. They haven't really fulfilled what they think it is they're supposed to be doing as adults, and they're starting to do that, and they're starting to, you know, get that first big relationship. Or now you're about 40 now.
Yeah.
Are your characters, do you think, going to reflect your age? Are they gonna be older now in your future writing?
Well, they are getting older.
They are getting older.
They are getting older. I like to keep them a little younger than me.
Gives you time to finish the novel, right?
Gives you time to finish the novel. It gives me time to reflect back on it.
Your books are written in first person, and they're written from the perspective of sons, not of fathers. But you're a father now, aren't you?
I'm a father twice now.
Is that changing your attitude towards family and toward how children are influenced by their parents? Because the characters in your books have all been a little stifled by their parents. And now you're one.
And I'm stifling my kids. I'm sure they'll be here, you know, if you have this job 20 years from now and my daughter's published her first novel, she'll be here, you know, trashing me to your audience. I don't know that it's changed my attitude too much. I think in many ways it's confirmed what I believe.
About family?
Right.
That it's stifling?
No, not that it's stifling, but its importance. It's importance. I think that, you know, every family gives its members something to overcome. What we try to do is give as much strength as we possibly can to our kids. And what it's confirmed to me is the, you know, the enormous weight of that relationship. And seeing the concentration in my children's eyes as they watch us and figure out what we're doing and what we mean reminds me of all the concentration that I put into my parents.
In the sex scenes that you have in your books, you bring into it things that writers usually leave out. And what I'm thinking is menstruation, birth control. These are the things that are usually absent in sexual encounters in books. And I'd like to know if that's intentional, if that's just the way you think, or if you intentionally wanted to work that kind of reality into the scenes. And I should say that your scenes are very mental in a lot of ways too. I mean, you're really kind of involved in the minds of the people who are involved in having sex.
Well, of course, you know, I don't try and figure out, you know, what other people have left out and then put
sure.
that into
he
my...
He left out the diaphragm. I'll put that in this book.
Right. Yeah, what's up? Wait, has Updike ever done this? I think that you know, in the times I've written about sex, and it's been, you know, long passages about it, that the sex becomes a kind of ritual, a kind of discovery of the other and of something in oneself. And it seems that the avenue to that discovery is in the reality of the body, and the body is concentrated on and then finally gone beyond. And what really does not interest me in sex is all the stuff about power and all the stuff about image and all the stuff, you know, I got her to do this and she's, you know, wondering if I can do this. That stuff, I think, is pretty dull and finally almost ugly. But what does interest me about sex is the, you know, is that possibility for, you know, for nirvana that it offers. And it seems that in order to reach that, you have to go through every bothersome reality that the body presents. And a lot of that is, you know, birth control and menstrual blood and all the other wonderful things that are part of our sexual nature.
In your novels, there's usually someone who's trying to figure out who they are and how they're going to get there, and they're kind of creating their life, and their life is usually getting out of their control. But I wonder at this point in your life how you feel about yours. I mean, do you feel like you're like establishing the kind of life that you meant to have or feel like you were supposed to have or want to have?
Well, I think I've been lucky in that I've been able to do a lot of what I wanted to do. But I don't know, maybe it's just a nature or maybe it's just a habit of thought. But I don't think there's a 2 months go by without me stopping and saying, what am I doing with my life? I mean, I can't believe that this is really what it is.
What do you think you should be doing?
When you have those moments of doubt. It's usually the opposite of what I'm doing at the moment. I suppose that, I'm living in the country. Gee, don't you think I should be living in the city? There's a, I suppose one of the things that interests me about fate is that, is the opportunity that it affords us to be lifted out of that kind of questioning and having to deal with something larger than ourselves.
So you believe in fate?
I don't know if I believe in fate with a capital F. I don't go to seances or read tea leaves, but I believe that that circumstance can take us to places that we couldn't have imagined.
I want to thank you so much for being here. It's really been great to meet you and
talk to you. Too.
My guest has been novelist Scott Spencer. His novels include Preservation Hall, Endless Love, and his new novel, Waking the Dead, which has just been published by Knopf. His name again, Scott Spencer. The book's name, Waking the Dead, just published by Knopf. It's 2 minutes to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at five for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Let's check in with Shatter Traffic.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Schuylkill westbound, a 20-minute delay between the Boulevard and City. Eastbound, 10 minutes in traffic at Conshohocken and north on 95. Slow going there between Penn's Landing and the Ben Franklin Bridge. In Abingdon, there's an accident, Rock Ledge at Huntington Pike. Also in southwest Philadelphia, an accident just cleared at 65th and Elmwood. Traveling south on Route 42, slow going there from 130 down through Route 55 on the eastbound lanes of the Amber Wilson Boulevard, approaching the airport circle. Police are checking on the report of an accident further east on Route 70, slow going at the Ellisburg Circle, then a heavy between 295 and Marl Crest. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Pep Boys. Let me tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by feminist lawyer Gloria Allred, who's the founder of the Women's Equal Rights Legal Defense and Education Fund. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Daily News sports columnist Ray Didinger. This Friday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Peter Guralnick, whose new book is titled Sweet Soul Music with Rhythm and Blues and the Southern Dream of Freedom. He's going to be playing some records when he joins us Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. And then Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be actor Alec Guinness, who will review his stage and screen career. So I hope you can be listening. Well, that about does it for today's program. Technical direction today from Orji Voblaitis and Ron Barron. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Special assistance today from Marty Morse-Cohen. Danny Miller and I are the producers of Fresh Air. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamber.
The Snow Adams with All Things Considered.
It makes no sense for the U.S. to continue to hold up the SALT structure while the Soviet Union undermines the foundation of SALT by its continued, uncorrected noncompliance.
The U.S. no longer bound by SALT II, a White House announcement today.
But the limits of the arms treaty will be respected until this fall. The story tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, East Germany tightening border crossing procedures with the West.
117 Soviets to be reunited with their families in the West.
The U.N. General Assembly begins a special session on Africa.
Land reform in Brazil, a fight between squatters and rich owners.
Network television turns 40, old enough to know better.
First, we have this news.
This is Mark Boardman. The White House announced today that it will stop complying with the provisions of the SALT II arms treaty if the Soviet Union fails to live up to the agreement. Spokesman Larry Speake said the U.S. might exceed the treaty's limits later this year if alleged Soviet violations continue. But for the time being, the U.S. will continue to abide by SALT II. Speke said two Poseidon submarines will be taken out of service tomorrow to make way for a new Trident sub. The retirements of the Nathaniel Green and Nathan Hale will allow the U.S. to maintain the nuclear warhead limits established by SALT II, the treaty which was negotiated nearly a decade ago but never ratified by Congress. Soviet officials said today that 117 people will be allowed to leave the USSR to join their families in America. The announcement came at the close of a human rights conference in Switzerland. The 117 Soviets involve 36 families and make up about 25% of the divided family cases that the U.S. has been trying to resolve. In Baltimore today, opening arguments were heard in the Ronald Pelton spy trial. The former National Security Agency communication specialist is accused of selling secrets to the Soviets over a 5-year period. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.